to actually remember to start the recorder for once. My cell phone is also a recorder. We need fewer and fewer gadgets as these phones get better. All right, I wanted to talk about fiction and anarchy, basically, from two directions. First, the ways in which my ideas have been affected by other people's fiction, and then towards the end, the way in which my fiction has been affected by my ideas. And I want to start out with the story of how I became an anarchist, because my political position at, I suppose, age 14 or 15, was essentially classical liberal. That is, I thought that the free market was the right way of doing things, but it had to function within a framework provided by something else that gave you your laws, law enforcement, that set of things. And that seemed to me pretty clear. I sort of felt as though there was a proof there, even if I couldn't exactly write it out, what I sort of think of as the classical liberal theorem that you can't run your market society without a non-market framework. And then I read the book up there, The Moon is a Harsh Mistress by Robert Heinlein, and he describes a society on the moon, one that's the result of the moon having been used as a penal colony the way Australia was. And there are lots of people on the moon who, legally speaking, are not convicts. They've served out their terms, or they're the children of convicts. But there's no government structure there. There's a prison, but they're not in the prison, and they've got to interact with the prison authority. And as he describes it, they develop their own set of institutions by which they are, in effect, enforcing laws and rights. And they're rather informal, somewhat ad hoc institutions. But as far as I could tell, it was a consistent story. It looked to me as though what he was describing in that society might plausibly enough work. And a theorem is destroyed by a single counterexample. All right? If there's really a proof that the framework for a market society has to be exogenous, then there can be no examples, even consistent hypothetical examples, of societies where it isn't. And that intrigued me. And so I started thinking about how you could have something equivalent to what he was describing in something much more like the society that I lived in. When you're writing an economics textbook, one of the things that's fairly common to do is start out with Robinson Crusoe. And as you go a little further, in my price theory book, for example, you develop a market society with all the complications left out. So that in the early chapters of my price theory, there are no firms, there are no middlemen, there are just producers and consumers, trade between the producers and consumers. There's no uncertainty, there's not even any change over time, every day is like the day before, and that gives you a simple enough model so you can sort of make sense out of it. And then you put in the complications chapter by chapter as the story goes on. And along similar lines, it seemed to me that one could start out with Heinlein's picture, and then try to see what the equivalent would be in a society which had intermediaries, large numbers, all of the sorts of things that real societies have. That ended up as my first book, Machinery of Freedom. Part three of Machinery is a sketch of a hypothetical anarcho-capitalist society, proprietarian anarchist society, you could call it, in something more or less like the world that I lived in which you had firms in the business of enforcing people's rights for them, and those firms had contracts with each other specifying the private courts that would settle disputes between them. And that was sort of my first book. It was a set of ideas that I still think are interesting and have a good deal to be said for them. I'm working on a third edition at the moment. One of the chapters I've written for the third edition is the Robinson Crusoe version of anarcho-capitalism. It's not Heinlein's version, but I'm sort of trying to imagine the simplest society in which something analogous, again, without middlemen, to what I'm describing would work as a sort of, again, a possibility proof. I want to say to people who say, well, not only would your system not work, it's obvious that it couldn't work. I want to say, well, look, here's a very, very simplified version. Looks as though that would work. Therefore, even though mine might be wrong, it can't be obvious that something like that couldn't work. As I got into it, some of my ideas got reinforced from the real world. There was an article written by two prominent Chicago School economists, Gary Becker and George Stigler, called On the Compensation of Enforcers, in which they were pointing out that our way of enforcing criminal law is not, in the jargon of economists, incentive compatible. And my version of their story is, you're a criminal, I'm a cop, I've got the goods on you. Your conviction is the equivalent to you to a $100,000 fine. My getting you convicted is the gold star on my report card, which will raise my lifetime income by $10,000. From the standpoint of Dragnet, it's obvious what happens. I hand the evidence over to the prosecutor and you go to jail. From the standpoint of an economist, it's obvious what happens. I have something, this body of evidence, that's worth $10,000 to me and $100,000 to you, and markets move things to their highest valued use. So you pay me a bribe somewhere between $10,000 and $100,000, and I burn the evidence. And Becker and Stigler suggested that one interesting way of solving this problem would be to shift to a system where instead of paying police salaries, when I got you convicted, I got the $100,000 you paid. And it was sort of a way you could imagine changing enforcement that they argued would at least eliminate this problem. And there was a response by Richard Posner and Bill Landis, his common co-author, in which, among other things, they pointed out that Becker and Stigler had basically reinvented tort law. That in tort law, the victim of a tort has the right to prosecute the tortfeasor, and he collects the damage payment, which is the equivalent of the fine paid by the tortfeasor. And they offered various arguments about how you would have to do the system and about reasons why it might not work for crimes. They were trying to sketch out a plausible case that the tort system worked for torts and didn't work for crimes. And I got interested in that and ended up writing two articles, one of which I'm not going to talk about, though it's sort of a theoretical article. But the interesting one was it occurred to me that I knew of a real-world society that had worked that way. I knew a little bit about saga period Iceland from 930 to about 1263. And that was, in fact, a society where when you killed people, his relatives sued you. It was more private than the Becker-Stigler version. Because after they got a court judgment, if you didn't pay the damages, the court outlawed you and they could then kill you. So that there was no state enforcement at all in that system. There was entirely private enforcement as well as private prosecution. So I assume it has something to do with the projector, no?
Would you mind switching that?
Turn it off for a moment, sure. That's my next slide, which is Njalsaga, Njalsaga is one of the Icelandic sagas. They were written down in the 13th and early 14th centuries. The events mostly take place in the 10th and early 11th century, and there's a long scholarly debate as to whether they were composed a little bit after the events and passed down as oral tradition, or whether they were composed by people who wrote it. We don't know the answer to that question. But the sagas give you a sort of first-hand description of a real functioning human society, which isn't quite anarchy, because they have a law code and then a legislature and a court system, but they have no executive arm of government. There's no enforcement of the law by any government actor. And that, I tried to work out how that system worked, tried to understand how they solved various of the problems that you would expect to arise with such a system. And that's why I was describing in my long title for this talk, fictional and semi-fictional sources, because Njalsaga is not entirely fictional. We don't really know how close a mixture of history and fiction there is in these sagas. We do know that Harald's saga describes events in Constantinople which largely mesh with the Byzantine historians, so that the sagas are at least in part historically accurate. How accurate to say, we don't really know. But in any case, that sort of filled me out, and I then kept doing stuff, because by this time, one result of my writing two articles responding to Landis and Posner was that they invited me to come to the University of Chicago Law School as a faculty fellow in law and economics, and I then spent a good many years, spent about 8 years on a one-year fellowship studying things, and I continued doing so when I moved to the law school. I'm now at Santa Clara University, and I looked at a variety of other real historical societies to fill out my sort of theoretical arguments. And I found out, for example, that 18th century England was more like Iceland than most people assume. Because it's true that on paper, 18th century England had the same legal system we do. That's where we got it from. The only trouble was they had no police or public prosecutors. So criminal law was, in fact, privately prosecuted, usually by the victim or the agents of the victim. And so that got me curious, how did that system work? And it turned out that one of the holes in my theoretical model Which is basically, how do you get people prosecuted if it costs more to catch them than you can collect from them in damage payments after you win? Why don't you just forget about it in that case? They had solved that problem. And the solution to that problem in 18th century England was an institution called Society for the Prosecution of Felons, or Felonies. And this was an organization typically in a single town or city, the members of which paid an annual fee to the organization, and that pooled money was used to prosecute anybody who committed a felony against any member. And that sounds at first like insurance, but the final step in the process is publishing the list of members of the association in the local newspaper for the felons to read. So that what it actually is a way of pre-committing to prosecute in order to make deterrence into a private good rather than a public good. Because people know if you're a member of the association, if you're an ordinary person, I commit a felony against you, there's a pretty good chance that you just won't bother to go to all the trouble of getting me prosecuted and maybe hanged or transported, because you don't get anything out of it. But if you're a member of an association, the association's got the money for that purpose, and knowing that you're a member is a reason not to commit a felony against you. So it was sort of a neat way, if you think about why in the public system are we willing to prosecute criminals even though we don't expect usually to get anything out of them? We want to deter crime. Well, can you turn deterrence into a private good? And the answer was that they had a way of doing it. And I thought that was quite neat and quite interesting. And I kept on learning about more such things. My current project is a book on legal systems very different from ours, which is coming out of a seminar on that subject. I've taught a number of times at Santa Clara. And it was really inspired by my work on Iceland and 18th century England, because both of those, writing those articles was a lot of fun. I figured I learned interesting stuff both about those societies and about the possibilities for legal systems, ways in which you might perhaps make a modern legal system work better. And I figured I'd been lazy for too long. And the problem, I needed a commitment strategy. I needed a way of making myself do some more work. So I figured if I invented a seminar on legal systems very different from ours, I would then have to learn enough to teach the seminar. So I did, and I went into our library, and I asked them to find me all the relevant books, and they gave me this one of these rolling bookcases with two or three rows of books on odd legal systems, and I went through them and ended up with 8 or 10 interesting legal systems. A few more got added as I taught the seminar, got bored with one and put in another. And so forth. Among the ones that I discovered, one of them was Somali. It turns out that the traditional Somali institutions, I originally learned about them from a book written by a fellow libertarian, a Dutch lawyer who spent his last 12 years in Somalia, and he didn't quite finish the book, and it was then edited by an American libertarian, and I don't trust books written by people who agree with me, because I'm going to be insufficiently critical of them. But then I did a little more research and discovered that the leading expert on traditional Somali law was a retired London School of Economics anthropologist. When I was looking in a university library for stuff on Somalia, I think the first two or three books I found he had written, and the next book was a festschrift in his honor by some other people. So I read his stuff, I emailed him, he wasn't willing to answer my questions, but he told me which of his books had the answers to my questions, and so I ended up with a reasonably accurate picture. And Somali system is really interesting. It's sort of like the Icelandic system and sort of not like a traditional Somali system, which existed back before Italy and England had Somalia, and which in the north, in the English part, more or less continued under the English occupation, and then when England and Italy pulled out, they set up a centralized government for a society that had never had a centralized government, and that was a democracy for a little while, and then it became a military dictatorship, and then it got into a war with Ethiopia, and then it crashed and burned, and then the UN decided that Somalia had to have a central government, has been trying to establish one ever since, and people near Mogadishu have figured out that if you're going to have a government, it's better to be the governor than the governed, and so they've been fighting over who's going to be it. Meanwhile, up in the north, the Somali have set up what they call the Republic of Somaliland, which is sort of a little bit of a government much more nearly based on the traditional institutions, and except for the fact that nobody will recognize it, because we'd have to admit Somalia wasn't one country, it seems to do at least tolerably well. But in any case, the traditional institutions are ones in which, as in Iceland, law enforcement is essentially private. They don't have an explicit law code, but they do have traditional law. They don't have a formal court system, but they have traditional mechanisms for arbitrating disputes. and they have an elaborate system of pre-made coalitions, a sort of hierarchical system of coalitions based partly on kinship and partly on explicit contract, so that any Somali can tell you his genealogy for 20 generations up, because it's relevant to who his likely allies are going to be, and you will have two coalitions which could be enemies, but then if they run into some other force group too large to deal with, they merge into a bigger coalition. It's a very complicated and interesting system. But what was interesting was just showing a different way in which a society with nothing that looked like our idea of government nonetheless could do at least a tolerable job of enforcing rights. One of the fun things in all these projects is when you're studying one society and you come across evidence relevant to your conjectures about another one. So that, for example, I had discussed in my old article on Iceland the possibility that the legal rules could get changed due to the threat people had that if I don't think the payment for killing my kinsman is high enough, I'll just kill the guy who did it and then the payments will cancel. So you have a mechanism, as it were, with a threat of opting out. It turns out there's an incident that this LSE fellow records in Somalia at one point where there's conflict between two groups and they decide they're killing too many people. It's gotten too violent. So they agree to raise the wehrgeld, to raise the payment that you owe for killing somebody. Both groups agree to it. And that was quite neat. And it goes along with a little bit, it's not really about stateless societies, but one of the other puzzles in my 18th century English piece was why it was that you have this bloody code where all serious offenses are capital, but only a fairly small minority of the people charged with those offenses actually get hanged. And some of them are acquitted, some of them are convicted of lesser included offenses, some of them are pardoned on condition of transportation, meaning they become indentured servants in the New World for 17 years, some are pardoned on condition of enlisting in the Army and Navy, and some are just pardoned and sent home. You were sentenced to hang by the neck until dead. Now go home and don't do it again. And I was trying to make sense of that. And it turns out that Boswell, who is mostly known for having written a very famous biography of Samuel Johnson, also wrote memoirs. He was a Scottish lawyer. And one chunk of his memoirs involves his efforts to get one of his clients pardoned. And they fit quite neatly into my conjecture of what was going on in that system, which was that you were, in effect, selling pardons for political, not financial payments. That what was really going on was an exchange of favors up a hierarchy of authority, and sure enough, there is Boswell going to every important person he can think of and basically trying to get them really as a favor to him to petition even more important people to get his client, to get his client off. So that was really quite fun. Anyway, one of the other things I looked at in doing this book was literature on the Plains Indians. The Cheyenne are the best recorded of them. There's a book on the Cheyenne. And part of what's fun about that book is that one of the authors was a very prominent legal scholar of, I suppose, about the 1930s, associated with sort of left-wing legal philosophy of the time. But his attitude to the Cheyenne is just like my attitude to my Icelanders. Namely, these really are grown-ups. Their system probably made some sense. Let's try to understand it. Rather than, these are barbarians and we know they got it all wrong. So that was really quite a lot of fun. The book's called Cheyenne Law, if you want to look at it. But I also looked at the Comanche. And the Comanche are another Plains tribe, far and away the most successful Plains tribe from a military standpoint. The Comanche blocked American expansion across Texas for a generation. And they're doing this with inferior technology and inferior population. And they're really good at fighting. They're anarchists. All right. One of the problems if you're an anarchist is figuring out how you defend your society against states, which are likely to want to conquer it. And it was at least interesting to see that this particular anarchist society, not a very pleasant one, I should say, it's not one I would like to live in, but a society without government, but with its own set of sort of norms, customs, ways of getting status and so forth, was actually quite good at fighting wars. And that was sort of intriguing as well. In a way, that gets into something I'll discuss a little bit later when I mention my first novel, where one of the issues is how do you manage an army when you don't have a state to pay it. So one of the things that came out of a bunch of that, out of the, in particular, the Somali and the Icelanders, but also, it turns out, some of the gypsy groups, is understanding feud. That feud is sort of a negative term in our mythos. Feud, by the way, has nothing to do with feudal. The words happen to sound the same. They are etymologically unrelated, unrelated in meaning. The basic guts of feud as a way of enforcing legal rules is that if you wrong me, I threaten to harm you unless you compensate me. And the essential requirement for feud to work is some mechanism by which right makes might. Some reason why threatening to harm you is more believable when you really have wronged me than when I only claim you have. Otherwise, it becomes straight extortion. So then in the Icelandic system, they've got their explicit court system, and it's only after the court has outlawed you that the rest of the society sees it as legitimate for me to go after you and illegitimate people to defend you. There's a wonderful bit in Njalssaga where a particular conflict looks as though it's going to break into open fighting in the middle of the open-air courtroom. And somebody on one side goes to a sort of benevolent neutral and says, if it does come to fighting, what will you do to help us? And he says, well, if you're losing, I'll draw my people over their arm. If you're losing, we'll come in and you know, keep you from getting hurt. You can retreat behind us. If you're winning, we'll break up the fight before you have killed more men than you can afford. All right? So the assumption here is that even when things are breaking down that badly, eventually when the dust settles, if you kill people, you're going to pay for it. Because that's the law. So in any case, going on, feud systems seem to be very interesting, and there's a sense in which what I was inventing in my book a long time ago was sort of a modern, highly developed feud system, in the sense there is no overarching authority, but there are organizations which in principle can use violence against each other, but in practice don't find it their interest to do so, because litigating is a lot less expensive than killing each other. You don't have to pay much hazard pay to your employees. They all recognize that having peaceful ways of settling their disputes is a sensible thing to do. And in fact, if you look at the Icelandic sagas, people who sort of look at them casually say, aha, look how violent the society is. Then you look a little more carefully, and you notice that in chapter 14, there's some fighting and someone is killed. And in chapter 15, there's some fighting and someone is killed. Only one of the people who is fighting in chapter 15 wasn't born in chapter 14. That what they're doing is telescoping the story to get to the fun bits. And I think the evidence suggests, I've discussed this with one scholar at UCLA, Jesse Bayak, who knows much more about Iceland than I do, and he, I think, agrees with my view that it was not, in fact, a very violent society. I like to claim, without much data, but I think it's a plausible statement, that England, Norway, and Normandy lost more men to violent conflict in 3 weeks of the year 1066 than Iceland did in the final 50 years of violent breakdown of its feud system. Those of you who know English history can work out which 3 weeks I mean. So in any case, all of that was stuff where I was trying to understand how it worked. Let me now go on to talk a bit more about science fiction. And about lessons that I think I've picked up by reading other people's views of anarchy. And I will start, I don't know if it's worth trying to turn this on again, maybe not, I've got covers of lots of books, but you want to try turning it on and see if it'll work? Because I just wanted to show cover pictures, which are really not relevant to what I'm saying, except they're sort of nice pictures.
Let's see.
Yeah. All right, well, Werner Vinge is a science fiction writer. I think he's one of the best idea people. I think Larry Niven is the person I would have said 15 years ago is the best idea person, at least that I read. And Vinge is a serious competitor. And that's Njalssaga, which is the one I was just referring to. And Vinge has a short story which is included in this collection, True Names and Other Dangers. And the short story is called The Ungoverned, which suggests what it's about. And it's a description in a future society, some sort of a post-cataclysmic society. I don't think in that story he goes into much detail, although it fits into some of his other stories, of a stateless area invaded by an adjacent state. And I'm particularly fond of the story because at the very end he cites my book, Machinery of Freedom, for a formal model of the kind of stateless society he's imagining. But there are a couple of things that I learned from the story. And one of them was seeing how different a political set of political institutions looked envisioned by a novelist instead of by a political theorist. Because he's sort of putting the color and taste and smell into it. So that the particular protection rights enforcement agency, which is central to that particular story, is called Al's Protection Agency. or maybe Owl's Protection Racket, I forget. And there's another one which is called the Michigan Police, because apparently the state of Michigan had state police that had a pretty good reputation. And there's all this sort of style and such going in. But the other lesson, the really interesting lesson, has to do with how people who are used to a particular set of institutions view other institutions. Because part of what's happening in the story is that within, I should say, the stateless society is a good deal richer than the state that's invading it. It's more sort of advanced. And in that society, there are people who Vinja calls armadillos. And an armadillo is somebody who doesn't like the whole system of arbitrated disputes and sort of pulls out of it and becomes a sort of a high-tech hermit, as it were, and has as little to do with this other people as possible. And in his story, there's an armadillo. He's a rich farmer whose son lost a law case that the father thinks he should have won like 20 years earlier. And he's been putting all his spare income for 20 years into turning his farm into a fortress, just in case. The state army invades, and a couple of teenagers manage to launch a sort of a fake attack on it from the direction of the farm. I think they're using fireworks or something of the sort. So the army aims itself at the farm and runs into a fortress. It never occurs to them that all they have to do is walk around it. All right, from their standpoint, it's a fortress. We're invading this place. Obviously, it's part of their defensive system. So they attack the fortress, and because the defenders are richer than they are, this one farmer has got a fortress that slows them down for a while, and you know they've got to use noticeable amounts of effort, but of course they eventually take it out. At which point it turns out that he has one last-ditch defense. He has an atomic bomb and a deep hole. And he sets off the atomic bomb above his head. His family goes into a very deep shelter, sets off an atomic bomb above his head, takes out about a third of the invading army. There is a representative of the local rights enforcement agency who is a prisoner of the invaders at this point, sort of in their office. And the leader of the invaders turns and says, "What kind of swine are you using nukes against us?" And the guy looks at him, sort of in puzzled astonishment. "What do you mean us? He's not our customer." And that just struck me as a really striking point, the same point made earlier by the fact they didn't walk around the farm, that each society interprets things in their own terms. So that the people from a state take it for granted that all military activity on the other side must be under a hierarchical control of the government, even if it pretends not to be, is sort of their view of it. Gangsters is their term for the protection, for the rights enforcement agencies. And the guy from the stateless society doesn't even occur to him they look at it that way. I mean, you know, he's not our customer. What do we have to do with what he does? And I thought that was really neat. So that's in True Names. Now, I should mention, since the book there is True Names, the story True Names is also has some ideas that I think are quite important for modern anarchists, although not the ones I'm mostly talking about, because the story True Names is about anonymity online, that there's a sort of trope in fantasy fiction that if a magician has to conceal his true name, because that way people can't do magic against him. And in the story True Names, it looks like a fantasy but turns out to be science fiction, because the people are interacting as the equivalent of your character on World of Warcraft in a early computer network, and the critical secret is who they really are. Because as long as you don't know who somebody really is, you can't arrest him, sue him, assassinate him, or whatever. And that, I think, suggests one of the possible routes to something that looks a lot like anarchy in the world we really live in, namely that it is possible using public key encryption to have a world where it is very hard for governments to keep track of people. Whether it'll happen, I don't know, but it's at least technologically possible. And it is, I think, quite likely that over the next few decades, more and more of human activity will move online, virtual reality gets better, more employment is absentee, you know, distance employment and so forth. And if you end up in a world where governments still control real space, but cyberspace is a government-free zone, in effect, and 90% of what we're doing is in cyberspace, we are, in a certain sense, most of the way to what anarchists would like. So that really comes out of True Names, not the main thing I was talking about now. But I thought I should mention it. Let me go on to something by people who are not anarchists. This is a novel, Oath of Fealty, by Larry Niven and Jerry Pournelle. And it's a novel that I think has a very interesting lesson. What's happening in the novel is that at some point in the past, there have been riots in Los Angeles that have more or less burnt out a chunk of the city. And the city government of Los Angeles makes a deal with an international corporation. And the corporation builds an arcology, basically a single building that's a functional small city on the ruined area, and subcontracts government. As you may know, this is what Jews in the Middle Ages quite routinely did, that in medieval Europe and Islam, most Jews were under Jewish law, because most of the non-Jewish rulers subcontracted ruling their Jewish subjects to the Jewish communal authorities in exchange for tax payments, essentially. So in that same system here, that Todos Santos, which is the arcology, it provides law enforcement within its territory, it charges its tenants whatever they agree to pay, and they don't pay any taxes. They have basically no governmental-style interaction with city, state, or federal government. And as the story goes on, one of the things you notice is that you can tell who's from Todos Santos when you see them walking around Los Angeles. They move differently. They look differently. They're foreigners. And what happens in the plot is that for reasons I don't remember, the local environmentalists are against Todos Santos. They think it's anti-environmental. And the result is a fake terrorist attack. A bunch of probably college student-age people carrying boxes that are labeled to look as if they're boxes of dynamite, though they really aren't, break through Todos Santos' defenses. They've done a good job of sort of hacking into the computer system and disabling layers of defenses. And they're heading for the line that brings hydrogen into Todos Santos as this energy source, and dynamite there would kill a huge number of people and do a huge amount of damage. And the last-ditch defense of that hydrogen pipe is lethal gas. The guy who's in charge of Todos Santos is out of town. His deputy bites the bullet, pushes the button, and kills whatever it is, four or five or six fake terrorists, one of whom turns out to be the daughter of a high-ranking Los Angeles politician. He is arrested, charged with murder. The newspaper reporter, who, as I remember, is the point-of-view character for the story, goes to the guy in charge of Todos Santos, who of course has come back, and he says, if you let me cover the story, I won't tell. What won't you tell? That you're going to break him out of prison. How do you know we're going to break him out of prison? Because all your people expect you to. Because from the standpoint of the inhabitants of Todos Santos, he isn't a fellow citizen who has unfortunately suffered a miscarriage of justice. He's a prisoner of war, seized by the foreign state, which launched, it's true it was a pretend attack, but looked like an attack designed to kill them. He was defending them. He is now a prisoner. Obviously, we should break him out. The point of the story, in my view, is the title Oath of Fealty. The point of the story is that when you have a private organization which is serving the functions of a state, it is likely to become the focus of the same emotions, the commitments that we now tend to focus on the nation state. And that I thought was a very interesting point. It's in some ways encouraging and in some ways discouraging for anarchists. It suggests some things about how an anarchist society might defend itself, but at the same time it also suggests ways in which whoever is enforcing rights might be in a position to violate rights because people would treat them as a state. But I just thought it was very interesting. Let me go on to a much older story that some of you may have read. It's a lot of fun, The Syndic, by I thought it was Paul N. Kornbluth, but this says just Kornbluth. The Syndic is set in a world where government has collapsed. I don't think they go into any details as to why. And in the United States, the criminal or organized crime has replaced it. And the eastern half of the United States is run by the Syndic, and the western half by the mob. And the mob territory is a pretty unpleasant sort of dictatorship. But the Syndic are really pretty nice guys. As long as they get their cut, they don't mind what you do. It's true they play a version of polo using jeeps and machine guns and to move the metal balls around. And they, presumably the Syndic aristocrats, are doing pretty well. But they aren't particularly oppressive. It's on the whole a reasonably attractive society. Meanwhile, there's still a government of the United States. The government of the United States is a terrorist organization existing on some islands in the Atlantic. I don't remember if they make clear what they really are. And it sends people to blow stuff up in Syndic territory. And the protagonist, who is a young Syndic aristocrat, infiltrates the government of the United States, observes how horrible they are, comes back and goes to, I think, his uncle, who is an important Syndic aristocrat. You know, we got to do something. We got to destroy them. And he goes, no, no, no. any serious attempt to turn us into sort of the kind of organization that can wage war is going to destroy us. It's true. They blow things up. Industrial accidents happen. The government of the United States finds it really frustrating that they blow up a chemical factory and nobody credits them with it. I was reminded of this, it was either this morning or last night, because as you may know, at the same time we've been getting a whole lot of publicity for a relatively small explosion in Boston that killed three people, there was just an explosion in a fertilizer factory in Texas, either today or yesterday, which killed, I don't remember how many, 40 or quite a large, much larger number of people. But almost certainly it wasn't a terrorist one, and so even though the damage is much larger, it doesn't get the visibility. And the basic lesson that in Syndic, I think, which is a not implausible lesson, is that you may have a society which, in order to do the obvious things to defend itself, would subvert its own system. And therefore, with luck, the people who are attacking you aren't doing enough damage, so you can't just ignore it and go on living, which is what the sort of conclusion there is. And that then reminded me of another and much grimmer story. It's a one of a series which I don't like, and I dislike it for reasons that are my fault, not the author's. And this is the Draca novels. I don't know how many of you read them, by Sterling. I don't like them because he does a plausible job of describing a ugly and evil society that works. All right, if you imagine sort of what the Nazis would like to think they were, and by the end of the series, they've conquered all of Earth. One of the things that happens at one point in this series of novels, the Draca start out in South Africa. It's an alternate history where a combination, if I remember correctly, of the Boers and I think maybe refugee Confederates from the American Civil War, I don't remember the details anymore, but they build a sort of a nationalistic, militaristic, reasonably free enterprise within being nationalist, a strong government but a private property system. And they start expanding up Africa, defeating African tribes and incorporating them into their military and as slave soldiers, Mamelukes, and so forth. And they take advantage of World War I to grab the Middle East and of World War II to grab Europe, basically. They defeat both sides in World War II while they're fighting each other. And you then end up with them against America. And the point is made pretty explicitly that they are a more rigid society than America, less innovative, but they've got a solution to that problem. Just do enough damage to America, be enough threatening to America, so the Americans start shutting themselves down. So we invent the TSA and the equivalent in a bunch of things, and we become a steadily more rigid, less progressive, less intellectually lively society, and the result is we lose our advantage over them and they eventually defeat us. It's a pretty grim story, but, you know, I can't really blame Sterling because he's a good writer. It's just he's a good writer writing things I don't want to believe. Let me go on to a couple of other stories that have to do with anarchy, one which I didn't learn as much from, I think, as some of these, but are interesting. The Dispossessed by Ursula Le Guin is a very well-known book. My view of that book is that she gets the anarchists right and the non-anarchists wrong. That is to say, she is presumably an anarchist, or at least sympathetic to the anarchists, and she shows how the anarchists, in some sense, have various internal problems in their society, which almost certainly any real anarchist society will have. The problem is that the alternative society reads to me like America as described by a loyal citizen of the Soviet Union in 1960 who'd never seen America. It's a sort of, to me at least, a sort of a parody of what a real market society was like. Furthermore, the market society is in a rich environment with lots of water, a planet, the anarchists on a moon, which is very scarce, so you can sort of say, well, the only reason anybody would live in the non-anarchist society is their natural advantages, not their system. So in that sense, it seemed to me she played fair with one half of the problem and unfair with the other. And that gets me to somebody who did... Oopsie. That's The Dispossessed. Didn't I have it already? Maybe I have it twice or something. Anyway, that's the next one. L. Neil Smith is not as good a writer as Le Guin. He's one of my people, politically speaking. He's a libertarian anarchist. And he wrote a series of which the first one is The Probability Broach, which are an alternate history where the Constitution was an unsuccessful coup against the Articles of Confederation, and the Articles of Confederation then spun on to less and less government instead of more and more. And the trouble is that he's the other way around. His anarchists have things, in a sense, much too easy. He doesn't, I think about what are the problems that society would have and so forth. So not a very satisfactory one. I ought to mention another fairly well-known collection of stories, several of which depict stateless societies. The Great Explosion by Eric Frank Russell is a collection of stories. One of them, I think, is Then There Was None, where the spaceship from Earth, which is trying to reestablish Earth's rule over its dispersed colonies, which have all gone in every which direction, and the spaceship from Earth is trying to force these anarchists to become part of sort of Earth's state. And the trouble is that one by one, the crew of the spaceship defect, because the anarchist society is a much more attractive society than theirs, and, you know, you're ordered, you know, I will court-martial you if you do it that way. You're never going to find me. I'm going to just vanish into their society. And that was sort of fun. On the other hand, it's either in that story, I think it's in that story, certainly in one of the Eric Frank Russell stories, he's got a monetary system based on OBS, which is short for obligations, where when I do something for you, you're planting an OB, and I'm planting an OB, and now you owe me something, and I can transfer that to somebody else. But he never, as far as I know, thinks through the question of how do you quantize these? How do you determine how big an obligation I owe? How do you have the equivalent of a market with prices going up when things are scarce and down and so forth? So I didn't think Eric Frank Russell was a very good economist, but he's a good writer, and I thought he had did an interesting job of trying to portray a stateless society. Let me go on to another person who I also don't agree with all that much, but who I like. Ken MacLeod is a Scottish science fiction author. As best I can tell, he's a Trotskyite. He has actually written things defending Joseph Stalin, which is not something that I would expect sensible people to do. But he's also a bright and interesting guy who has a very wide range of interests. And it's quite clear that he is interested in both what are loosely described as right-wing anarchist and left-wing anarchist thoughts. I think propertarian is probably better than right, and I'm not sure if communitarian or communal or communist or something like that is the best description for left. But as I see it, the fundamental difference is whether you see private property and trade as the problem or the solution. Do you see it as the way of having decentralized coordination, or do you see it as the source of economic oppression, loosely speaking? That would be a long talk today. Would require someone on the other side to argue with to make it interesting. But the basic point is that Ken is familiar with both, and you see proponents of both. One of his funny things is that he's got a future sort of the kind of left anarchist society where the reason you don't need private property is that everything is free because the society is so productive due to high tech. And in the planning hall of the central organization, because there is an organization of some sort of this anarchist society, there is a gold statue of Ludwig von Mises, who is the person largely responsible for making the arguments for why central planning couldn't work. And I don't think Ken has ever explained to me, at least, why these anarcho-communists think of Mises as sort of somebody they want to pay tribute to, but I see it at least as just sort of evidence of Ken's Catholicity, so to speak, his breadth of mind. And in, I think it's that same society, you have a society where most of it is common ownership, everything free, anarchy, but there are some proprietarian enclaves, people who don't like that system. And they want to find their equivalent of Albert Einstein, the guy who invented their faster-than-light drive, to go with them on an expedition where they want somebody really smart with them. And they go looking for him, and they find him in one of the proprietarian enclaves. And there again, it seems to me that Ken is, in a certain sense, signaling his ambiguity about these different systems. And I think there's a good deal of his writing where I get that feeling that he probably knows which side he's on, but he finds all of the sides interesting and therefore does a reasonable job of portraying both in one clay case a proprietarian anarchist society and on a planet in one of his stories and the common ownership anarchist in another. All right, let me go on from this to what I, like any author, really like talking about, which is my own work. My first novel was called Harald. It was published by Bain. And they marketed it as a fantasy. But what it really is a historical novel with made-up history. I made up my map. I made up my history. I created societies based on various historical societies. The technology is pretty much all medieval or classical real technology. And I told a story in it. It was not intended as propaganda for anarchy or anything else. On the whole, I disapprove in that sense of Ayn Rand and L. Neil Smith and other people, and for that matter, of George Bernard Shaw. It's, I mean, they're all people who wrote books worth reading, but it seems to me that you're better off telling a story and letting the story, you know, convey any interesting ideas, not starting out by saying my objective is to preach Sermon X. So I'm not preaching any sermons. But in my society, my protagonist is coming from a semi-stateless society, one which was inspired by Saga period Iceland, although I've tweaked the institutions a little bit. His ally is was the king of something a little bit like early Norman England, a feudal society. The antagonist state is something loosely based on Roman, Byzantine, and Abbasid models, an expanding empire, which is north of them and is trying to push south into their territory. And the one other player in this game is a female military order. I mentioned my having female warriors. I can claim no decent historical warrant for a female military order, although I was thinking of things like the Templars in terms of military orders. But there are a couple of, at least two ways in which I think I managed to get across points that should be of interest to anarchists in the story. One of them being two different ways of looking at the world, or at least the political world. What's happening in my plot is that prior to the story beginning, there was a king of the kingdom of Caerlea who was a highly admirable person who lots of people liked. The Vales, where my protagonist comes from, was settled from Caerlea quite a long time ago. And for a long time, the kings of Caerlea tried to claim rulership over the Vales unsuccessfully, because the Vales are on the other side of a high mountain pass. So it's possible, you know, in half the year you can get across, half the year you can't. And eventually, a king becomes king of Caerlea who realizes this is a really stupid idea. These people ought to be our friends, not our enemies. They're our kinsmen, ultimately. They speak more or less our language. And so he abandons the claim to rulership, and when there's a famine in the Vales, he does everything he can to feed them. He sends all of the food that he can transport over the mountain pass and makes them friends. The result is that for about the next 30 years, there is an alliance of the Kingdom of Caerlea, the Vales, and the order, my military order, which is blocking the expansion south of the empire. That's my background situation just before the story starts. The king dies. His son succeeds, and the son, unfortunately, has not been properly trained for the job for reasons which I imply at various points in the story. The son's view of the world is tables of organization, is hierarchy. His view is those people in allegiance to him he can trust. It's a feudal system. They'll do what he tells them. Those people not in allegiance to him he can't trust. How can he defend his kingdom when two-thirds of the army can go home if it wants to? Because what's been defending the kingdom is an army that's partly the kingdom, partly the order, partly the Vales. I should say my protagonist was the old king's general. My protagonist is a prominent figure in the Vales. I'll discuss in a little bit how he raises an army. But he's also a brilliant general. And since the previous king was a highly intelligent guy, he knew perfectly well his ally was a better general than he was. So he took care of holding the alliance together and such and turned over command to Harald, my protagonist. So what's the new king going to do? The new king decides, I've got to convert my father's allies into subjects. So he seizes the lady commander of the order, pretends that she's voluntarily gone into seclusion and turned over her authority to a kinswoman of his who's a high-ranking member of the order and will do what he tells. The order doesn't believe him. It's a very implausible story, and you get some ideas later as to who has more or less set him up with this implausible story, but he thinks that's what he's doing at least. And therefore there's a sort of an undeclared civil war between the kingdom and the order. He invites Harald to come across the mountains and join him in a council of war to figure out how to settle this problem. And Harald comes to him and basically says, you know, stop attacking the order. This is a really stupid thing to do. He's not willing to do that for various reasons. There is an assassination attempt on Harald. which Harald blames on the king, although he's wrong as it happens. Harald is injured. The king basically says, I won't let you go home until you're well. Harald says, I'm leaving. The king says, no, you aren't. Harald is cleverer than the king and gets out and leaves, then has various adventures on his way home, eventually comes back with a small army, has the problem of how to win a civil war without killing anybody, because what he wants to do is to force the king to back down, to stop, to release the lady commander, who's a friend and ex-lover of Harald's, as it happens, and the mother of Harald's oldest daughter, who's also a character in the story. And so there's a bunch of interesting stuff happening, which isn't too relevant to what I'm going to say. The interesting thing, though, is the difference between how James the king looks at the situation and how Harald does. Because James is seeing tables of organization. Harald is seeing networks of relationships. One of the most powerful of the king's feudal inferiors, Stephen, who's the lord of the North Province, which is the province on the border where a lot of the fighting with the Empire has happened, is also an old and close friend of Harald. And what you're watching is that it's fairly clear that Stephen will never say to the king, no, your majesty. He just won't do things. And there's a scene very early on where Harald comes upon a group attacking a small hold of the order and defeats the attackers, and then the question is, what are the survivors of the order to do? And he says, well, you could head north. Stephen's a fine man for failing when he wants to, and I can't see him hunting you with any enthusiasm. And that sort of is a serious point. Later, Harald himself, on his way back home, arrives at Stephen's hold. Stephen is careful not to make it obvious to everybody else there who his guest is. Stephen puts Harald in a guest house to get a good night's sleep because he's been up all night riding for various reasons in the story. Stephen says, you know, we'll talk in the morning, and delivers to Harald a meal consisting of about 3 days' worth of food, most of which keeps well. Come night, Harald takes the food, gets on his horse, and leaves. And it's supposed to be entirely clear that that's what Stephen expects to happen, but Stephen is maintaining plausible deniability so that if people do figure out what happened and do report it, the king said, well, you know, I didn't expect him to leave. So that the whole picture that I'm running through this is a picture of the difference between the politics of somebody who sees in hierarchy and the politics of somebody who sees in networks. And it eventually turns out, quite aside from Stephen, that the king is being manipulated by his cousin, who is in the pay of the enemy. You're not sure if he's really in the pay of the enemy or if he's planning to double-cross the enemy after he becomes king, but he's trying to usurp the throne, has sort of set King James up. Well, he's somebody who James takes for granted as loyal to him. So that James is wrong in both directions. He's wrong that he can't trust people who aren't in allegiance to him, because after all, his father defended the kingdom for 30 years with people not in allegiance to him. And he's wrong in thinking he can't trust those who can't. Meanwhile, Harald, later on in the story, the grandson of the emperor, is a hostage with Harald for a while. So Harald makes friends with him. And Harald's son and grandson make friends with him. And there's internal politics going on in the empire. And so Harald helps out one side in those internal politics, where it seems useful for his purposes to do so. So again, he's not seeing the whole... There's almost a sense in which states are transparent to him. That you know, the particular person in the empire is a person. We can interact with him. Maybe we have some interests in common. Maybe I can help him out. Maybe he can help me out. That kind of feel is running through everything that he's doing. So that was sort of one of the two relevant to anarchy lessons that I thought I had in that book. Neither of them, of course, made explicit. The other one was, I guess, more narrowly from the point of view of an economist. And that's the question of how you run an army when you don't have a state. Or more precisely, what are the advantages and disadvantages that Harald has vis-a-vis the emperor? Now, of course, Harald does have some forces from his allies, but his own troops are all volunteers from his own area. He himself has no political authority at all. For anyone familiar with Icelandic things, he's a sort of a super-Gothi. The Gothi, the mistranslated chieftain, is somebody who plays a role in the Icelandic legal system such that ordinary people plug into the legal system through him. But the ordinary thingman can pick any Gothi to be his Gothi, and he can change. So it's not like an ordinary feudal system where you're locked in, as it were. Sometimes call it competitive feudalism. And in my variant of the Icelandic system for my novel, the a bunch of Gothar, plural of Gothi, themselves have a Gothi to link themselves, and then it all goes up. And he's one of those. His title is Senior Paramount. Senior is purely a historical fact because he's from the first settlement in the Vales. Paramount means top of this level of people associated with running the legal system, but it doesn't mean he has any authority over anybody. He doesn't. But people outside of the Vales, and this is again going back to Werner Vinge's point, think of him as sort of the feudal lord of the Vales. Senior Paramount sort of sounds like that, and everybody has feudal lords, right? And James more or less knows it isn't true, but is trying to persuade Harald that he could be the feudal lord of the Vales with James' help, and that'll then put his other ally into James's system of hierarchy. And Harald's response basically is, if I tried to do that, I'd be at the wrong end of a lot of arrows. Besides which, I don't want to. But again, there's this whole clash of visions, as it were, of how political things are organized. But the other thing is, how do you raise an army? And basically, what was inspiring me, thinking about it historically, were the so-called Danes, the armies that ravaged England under the Anglo-Saxons. Because as best I can tell, those were not national armies. Those were entrepreneurial projects. They were basically a good leader with a reputation for winning battles who says to a bunch of people, come with me and we can get gold and maybe end up with some land and maybe some slaves. We can get nice stuff in England. Let's go fight. Now, in my case, Harald is fighting defensive wars, so it isn't as attractive a possibility. But nonetheless, when you defeat an imperial army, take people prisoner, ransom them back to the empire, take loot, it's fun, it's exciting. You can become a hero, you can have stories to tell your children, so that's sort of the underlying thing. And what does that mean? It affects his tactics in two ways. It's useful that I made him a military genius, right? Otherwise this wouldn't work. One of them is, he is very good at what his daughter refers to as my father's set piece battles. Everything important settled 5 minutes before it begins. That he's mostly fighting logistic warfare. He's mostly fighting battles in which the objective is to put the enemies in a position in which they either surrender or they die of hunger or thirst. And once they surrender, you then ransom them back to their superior officers, and now you've got some money for the next campaign. And that's sort of the basis. And I've got quite a fun passage in it where, at this point, the king is actually a prisoner of his as a result of the middle part of the conflict. But, of course, Harald's response to the king as a prisoner is to try to make him a friend. And in fact, it's supposed the second section of the book, I think, is called Paying Debts. And given how Harald has been treated in the first section, I think the readers assume it means getting revenge. What it actually means is that Harald thinks he owes a debt to the previous king, who was the person who put together the alliance, fed people in the Vales when they were starving, and so forth, and he wants to pay it by educating that king's son in the way he should have been educated, by making him into the king he ought to be. And so he's treating James, running around with him as a prisoner, as if he was sort of a junior officer or maybe one of his family, talking, chatting, explaining things to him, and so forth. And at one point, they're discussing tents. The Carolian army uses a wagon train and fairly substantial tents and so forth. The Vales people are horse archers, they're cataphracts, and they travel much more lightly with very, very light tents that they have with them, basically. And they're discussing the difference, and Harald says, you think your tents are a pain. You should have seen his Imperial Majesty's tent. How did you happen to be seeing the Emperor's tent? Oh, he wasn't using it at the time. Harald's daughter from out of the dark in this conversation. After the battle, and it's clear that what happened was a battle where the Imperial army had to abandon lots of stuff, including the Emperor's tent, father got some of the people to use their remounts and some of the Emperor's mules to pack the tent back over the pass. We set it up in the back pasture. Just what every back pasture means, Harald. Don't laugh. Walls of silk. Tent poles banded with gold. After a while, every highborn of the emperor had silken tents and gold tent poles. Made it a lot easier to recruit troops the next time. So what he's doing is deliberately cultivating the rumors that there's lots of loot in order to get people to volunteer. Meanwhile, we see that some of the problems that Harald faces, the empire faces too, that's just less obvious to them. Because the core of the empire's army is the legions, and they are very, very good heavy infantry. best heavy infantry in the world, at least in Harold's opinion. But they also use auxiliary troops who are recruited from either inside or outside the empire, but from sort of more or less from their standpoint, semi-barbarian people. And there's a point, the legionaries tend to think of the auxilia as dispensable. What's really critical is that the legions get home alive. And they lose a lot of the auxilia in several of the campaigns. And then there's a point where somebody's complaining, you know, we could deal with this problem if we only had some more of such and such a type of auxilia who are really good for stuff in the woods, which we're no good for. Yeah, you know, hire 1,000, only 500 of them get home, it's really hard to hire them next time. So that they are really facing Harald's problem, a less extreme form. The legions are professionals paid by tax money, but nonetheless, to some degree, the more they get their troops killed off, the harder it is to get troops in the future, which is basically a major part of Harald's point. I should say, I also have other fun with sort of Harald's, with the economics of what Harald is doing. There's a point at which Harald defeats an army which is working for the second prince. There are two princes and an emperor, and both princes want to be the heir, so there's rivalry between them, but not actual combat. And he defeats the second prince's army, and essentially they surrender. He sends the troops home on terms, and he auctions off their horses to the local plains nomads, because this is happening in an area, his territory is adjacent to a wide plain with lots of nomads who Harald gets along with pretty well. And in fact, the Vale's culture is sort of a hybrid of the Carolian and the nomad culture, it's pretty clear. Later on, Harald, on the other side of the Vale, in the kingdom, defeats the emperor's army and captures a whole bunch of horses. His allies bring the horses across a pass farther up north and offer them to the second prince. Understand, you're a bit short of horses just now. We've got horses. They even have the right brand. How many horses with the imperial brand would you like to sell us? You sure you want to know? And he's basically got this circular system where he captures horses from one person, sells them here, captures horses from somebody else, and sells them back to the second prince, who at the moment he doesn't think is very dangerous to him, who is needing horses for his cavalry because he's just lost them to Harald in the earlier round. And there's a line by the second prince's son, who's the one who had become friends with Harald and is now back with his father, that supporting an army from the resources of a mountain farm created problems to which Harald, being Harald, found his own solutions. And that sort of was part of the fun I was having about how in that kind of system, without the virtues of resources, you would support an army. So the final question is, what advantages, if any, does Harald have over the empire, other than the fact that the author is on his side, which is always a big advantage in any work of fiction? And the interesting comparison there, which I tried to imply, most of the stuff I don't explain, hopefully perceptive readers will see it, is between Harald and the best imperial general, a man called Artos, who's working for the second prince, loyal to the second prince. And there's an earlier battle with the empire when Harald discovers that the commander of the imperial army is not Artos and is very relieved. Comments to one of his people, I may get you back alive. And later he defeats Artos, but in a very difficult campaign. Artos is technically as competent a general as Harald is. The difference is that Harald does original, unconventional things that nobody would think of. Somebody who acted like that would never make it to the top of the imperial army. He'd probably get hanged long before he got there. Because at some point, his commander would tell him, do X, and he would say, I got this great Y, I'll do it. And then that's the end of his career. So part of the advantage, from my standpoint, of the stateless society is that it's got a lot more room for sort of originality and unconventionality. And if Harald's clever ideas were stupid, he'd get himself killed pretty soon. But in fact, they aren't stupid. And the result is that he has the reputation of being a brilliant general as a result. I should say one of my conclusions from writing my first novel is no plot survives contact with the characters. And there's a character I haven't mentioned who I think of as my stealth heroine, because when I originally thought up the story, she was the king's mistress who Harald was using to get ideas sympathetic to his side of the conflict with the order into the circles around the king to put on social pressure. And by the time the book is written, she is the noble woman the king is courting. Her telling the king, basically, you're acting like a villain and I'm not going to marry you, is one of the things that pressures the king into eventually realizing he's making a mistake and changing. But there's a point at which she's a prisoner of the empire, and she gets away by the kind of thing Harald would do. All right, she's a prisoner of the empire. She has a baby with her, makes it a little hard to escape. Her captors, her guards are there, and she's also got a lady in waiting who's a friend of hers. And there's a stallion which she's been told by his proud owner is the fastest horse in the army. She gets her lady in waiting to see an imaginary snake and scream to distract everybody for a couple of seconds. She has a knife hidden somehow. She cuts the tether rope for the stallion, slashes the stallion's rump, and steps under the boughs of a fir tree holding her baby. Everybody assumes she's on the stallion, go chasing after it. She climbs the tree with her baby, stays up there all night. Eventually the army moves off, she comes down and heads south. And it's intended to be, that's what Harald would have done if he had been a woman in that situation. That is some off-the-wall tactic where everybody, including her lady-in-waiting, assumes she's on the horse. There's an exchange with the owner of the horse who's worried that the queen she's married the king by this time, will kill herself, you know, riding this very dangerous horse with a baby in one arm. And her lady-in-waiting says, the province she grew up in, it is mostly fields. She rode before she walked. If you can handle that horse with two hands, she can handle it with one. But she's assuming she's on the horse, too. By the time it shows up in the sequel, which I partly wrote and then abandoned for my other book, it's a story about the queen turning into a horse and riding off. Because that's the way stories get transmitted by people and get changed. All right, let me say just a few words about my last novel, which is much less interesting from this standpoint. It's called Salamander. It's up as a Kindle. I didn't get a publisher because Harald didn't sell all that well, and getting published is hard, as some of you may know, and I figured I'd put it up and let people read it, and some people have read it and made interesting comments that I like, so that's been fun. Salamander really is a fantasy. I've got magic. I'm sort of proud of the magic. I think I've actually managed an original version of magic, which, after all these years of fantasy, is hard to do. But the one bit which is, I guess, sort of relevant to stateless kind of stuff is that in this, the society is somewhere between feudal Europe and 18th century England, politically speaking. And there are traditional decentralized mechanisms for regulating magic, which basically involve the fact that if a mage does things forbidden by the traditional rules, the other mages can call a court, convict him, ban him from the use of magic, and kill him if he keeps using it. There is also a royal official in charge of magic with a court system, which is gradually taking over from that system. And there's a point where the royal official finds that one of his people has broken the rules. That person takes it for granted, of course, my boss will let me off, I'm working for him. But in fact, the royal official doesn't, because he realizes that unless the mages see his system as legitimate, it may slide back to the traditional system, and that therefore gradually sliding into one where it always goes through the courts depends on being careful to maintain the view of legitimacy. And so he does, in fact, convict his employee of what he actually did. So that's the closest I come, because that has to do with some of these issues of sort of centralized versus decentralized control mechanisms. But what Salamander is really about is the magical version of the central planning fallacy, and that's a separate story, because we're really talking about stateless, not about what's wrong with central planning of economies, which is what's sort of going on in a magical version of the story. All right, I think I've finished what I wanted to talk about. I'd be happy to have your comments, questions, etc. Want to turn off this so it doesn't start burning again? Probably be prudent. Anybody? Anything? Yes?
When you're talking about high school,
yes,
we're talking about a very small society, especially right during that period of time. And I'm wondering whether or not all of these instances really don't depend in a certain sense on size. The plausibility of it seems to really rely upon that the community, the people at least have some knowledge of each other. There aren't strange people who come in to commit crimes and disappear. And if you look at, I've done some research on Sherlock Holmes. If you look at Holmes, those detective stories arise precisely when it's impossible to locate who did the crime. So things like courts don't work. So I'm wondering whether you think that's a fair.
It's certainly an important issue. The As you may know, there is sort of the historical question of why England moved from the 18th century privately enforced, first with the invention of the police by Peel about 1830, and then for about the next 40 years they didn't have public prosecutors, but the police acted as de facto public prosecutors and eventually put in public prosecutors. And one argument that's been offered is that it was because an increasingly anonymous city with society with urbanization, the system didn't work. I gather there are other people who have argued that that's wrong, that it was more nearly a matter of wanting to have control because they were scared about the French Revolution and various other things that were happening there, and they wanted some mechanism short of calling out the troops. So I'm not sure what the right answer is. But the other point, if you're thinking about our world, is that at the same time that we're become a much larger population, we also have much better information technology. And that cuts the other way, that it's true I can't personally know 300 million people, but I could practically fit them on my hard drive. That's only a slight exaggeration. And if you think about how we currently use the web when you want to use a motel or a restaurant, well, I can get information on a hotel 2,000 miles from my home in 20 minutes. Not perfect information, but of course you didn't have perfect information in traditional societies either. So I think that those things cut both ways. I certainly would not claim that there is any form of organization that's going to work in all environments. That one of the points I made in Machinery of Freedom, there are two qualifications I made there, and we'll be expanding on basically in the third edition. One of them was the problem of defending against aggressive nations. And I argued that basically there were imperfect ways of doing that, and how serious the threats were was going to be relevant to whether you could do it. Now, in that particular respect, we're much better off now. I wrote the book 40 years ago. We no longer have any enemies with any serious resources. I mean, we may talk as if we did. I did the arithmetic for the first Iraq War, and I added up the GNPs on both sides, and the odds were 100 to 1. That's not a war, or not a real war.
Given that, then you would see a trade-off, either anarchy or privacy. Maybe, except think
for a moment about my online anarchy. You could have very good information about your online persona without knowing what continent you were on, how old you were, whether you were a man or a woman.
Well, you have some of that in Second Life now, which is an example.
Yes.
Mike and I actually tried to run a class there a few years ago, and I did an investigation of it. And one of the concerns we had was exactly what happens to, you know, there are all kinds of terrible things that can happen to your avatars. They can be raped, they can be killed. You know, for somebody who's technically sophisticated, you're pretty powerless. And putting students in that context, you know, can be, you know, it seems like it's pretty innocuous, but it really is upsetting for people when that happens. So I'm wondering, I mean, Yes, it does look like anarchy, but it looked pretty lawless.
Second Life, I just have no experience with. But in terms of, because I've got this, it's an old piece on strong privacy, which I wrote a long time ago, which really came out part of Inge's ideas. We have the technology which is possible to structure online interactions in such a way that you can communicate with people without any third party observing it. You can pay them money without any third party observing it. You can prove who you are via digital signatures. And you can't get a bullet through a T1 line. So that all you can do is send information back and forth. And that in that sense, it seems to me that you can still have fraud, but you can't have force, so to speak. And that, it seems to me, gets a lot closer to anarchy. But I was going to mention, it's not really relevant to the online stuff, but one of the reasons why my model might not work is defense against foreign states. The other is internal stability. And that the critical issue there is how many rights enforcement agencies you have. If there's a small number, they can cartelize, reinvent government, decide robbery is more profitable than business, and you're in real trouble. If there are a large number, it's going to be hard to make a stable cartel. And one of the things that has changed in my view since I wrote Machinery is I got one good review of Machinery, where a good review is defined as one that makes me think. And that was by Jim Buchanan. And he raised the question that I had given an argument about the allocation, essentially in my system, what the rights would look like, but I hadn't thought about the question of who has to pay for them. that if I want one rule and you want the other, is that I have to pay you to get mine or you have to pay me to get yours. And thinking about that, it occurred to me that there might be economies of scale in threats of force, even if not economies of scale in enforcing rights. And that that could lead to an unstable situation where the agencies were too large. And that's a question I'll be discussing. I've discussed that in some talks. Yes?
Does it trouble you at all that the sort of system you're talking about very efficiently preserved radical inequality?
Well, radical inequality.
Radical economic inequality.
I mean, I don't know if that's radical. I would have said that all of the systems that...
radical the world we now live in.
Yeah, no. Yeah, not particularly. That is, as far as I know, all of the likely state societies do that. They just do a much more inefficient job of it. Iceland, I would have said, was probably rather more egalitarian than contemporary states.
One of the great virtues of writing novels or talking about ancient societies is that you can slide away from the fact that in the society we live in, as a consequence of the functioning of capitalism, there is radical economic inequality. And all the greater optimal efficient solutions preserve it. And so you just blink your eyes at that and write a novel in which you start off with a bunch of people who have roughly equal wealth, and you gimmick things so that you don't, after a couple of generations, have a kind of inequality that you have from the real world. You would.
In the case of my novels, the second novel, actually, there's a good deal of inequality. That one of the, not relevant to the discussion here, but one of the things I'm doing in that novel is to try to have, to show people who believably have a different set of values than we do, so that there's a woman who's the daughter of a powerful noble at the college where she's a student. She has a suite and the other students have one room, and nobody thinks anything of it. They sort of take for granted that that's the way important people get treated. But more generally, as far as I can tell, if you look at real non-capitalist societies, which the obvious developed ones would be the communist ones, they were more unequal, not less. That, you know, you have stories in the U.S. about people getting married in order to get permission to migrate to the U.S., and in Russia they did it to get permission to migrate to Moscow. Because they were outside of Moscow.
I'm not terribly impressed when we talk about this subject by citing the Soviet Union as though it were somehow the terrible next step. It isn't.
It is one example of a society not based on private property trade free markets. There might be other examples. I could certainly imagine within the kind of society I would like there being various subgroups who set up their own rules. But I don't know of any plausible set of institutions that generate equality, and on the whole, I am less interested in equality than in welfare. That I would say that in between a society where everybody is at 10,000 units and one where some people are at 10,000, some are at 20,000, I prefer the latter. I don't think the inequality doesn't strike me as particularly evil, and having resources and being able to get what you want seems to me is good.
I don't think there's just the fairest possibility that since all of us lead rather comfortable lives, it's easy for us to say that inequality doesn't concern us. But if in fact we were scrambling as a third or more of the population of the United States is, we might feel differently.
We might. I don't think a third of the population of the United States is scrabbling, but we could have a longer discussion on how you measure scrabbling. But I do observe in this system that in the inner city areas, which are where a good many of the poor people are, the clothing they wear looks an awful lot like the clothing everybody else wears. The food they eat isn't very different. And the two ways in which they are most seriously disadvantaged are police protection and schooling, both of which are provided by the state. So that on the whole...
Almost none of those propositions is true, what we're talking about.
All right. What about comparing the Gini Index, which measures inequality, to the Happiness Index, which shows that the lower the Gini coefficient index number is, the happier the population is, the more it lives, the healthier it is, the better its systems are in general.
Yeah. I guess the real answer is that I don't know enough about the happiness research, which I gather is somewhat controversial and fairly new subject to be able to judge whether that claim is true or not.
Well,
but
it's a growing social science, there's enough data now to show a very close correlation between less inequality and greater citizen satisfaction and health.
Controlling for what?
What do you mean by controlling for?
correlation is not causation, as you surely know.
I
understand. So the question is, what other variables are you controlling for when you find this correlation?
Well, you can start putting in political participation. You can begin to put in more and more metrics, but in essence, what they come down to is the people are healthier and happier in Cuba than they are here. People are healthier and happier
I doubt
in
it.
Well, why do you doubt it? Is the way
because I observe which way the population pressures go, which way people want to migrate.
This is where science helps. It's not anecdotal. It's not a matter of your observations. It's a matter of asking the actual people involved, the populations, and then correlating the data and then looking at the numbers.
I would have said that the question I want to ask somebody is not how happy do you say you are, but where would you like to live? And we observe that in people's actual behavior.
Well, but are you saying Cubans are not leaving Cuba en masse?
Well, Cubans are not permitted to leave Cuba en masse, but some noticeable number do, and we see very few people immigrating into Cuba.
This is a way of tweaking the historical and political situation. They've been under an embargo. They've been under an enforced lack of resources that they've had to make do with as a population. So they are a strange experiment.
They're being embargoed only by the U.S. There's all the rest of the world. You know, you may remember Northern Rhodesia, which was embargoed by the entire world except for those great economic social superpowers, Portugal and South Africa, and it had a civil war going on, and it lasted for, 15 years or so before it collapsed? The fact that the U.S. doesn't trade with Cuba undoubtedly makes them a little poorer, but I think the idea that that explains why they've gone from one of the richest societies in that part of the world to one of the poorest is not very plausible. I'm not in favor of the embargo. I'm in favor of free trade with them, but I don't think it has nearly as large an effect. I think that's just an excuse.
But then you look at all of the... I mean, essentially, the United States has a Gini index that is just short of the worst banana republics in the world. And the world itself,
are you measuring it by consumption or by income?
Well, by income. Yeah.
Do you realize why that's the wrong way of doing it?
Well, it is a way of doing it that measures an inequality that...
It does not. It does not. That's a mistake. Think about two societies in one of which individual incomes are very stable and in one of which they vary a lot year to year. If the average over several years of the inequality is the same in the two societies, that's the relevant question. But your Gini index measured by income is going to show one to be much more unequal than the other. And one of the advantages of measuring it by consumption is that people even out their consumption in that situation.
No, but the problem is the Gini index doesn't even measure true inequality because it doesn't measure assets. And so it's actually the case that the Gini index doesn't even get the inequality as bad as it is.
I'm sorry. How do assets affect how well off you are if you never consume them?
Are you serious?
Generally, that involves consuming something, namely buying a house.
It involves having assets that you can put up in order to secure a mortgage. Without the assets, you can't get the mortgage.
Can I ask you a question that sort of overarches both of these points?
Sure.
I think this goes to the heart of the question, which is to say, does our relative welfare matter, or does our positional status matter? Right? Because we may be, I might have $1 million and a Corvette. If everybody else has Lamborghinis and $1 billion, I feel poor.
Well, that's an interesting question. As you know, Robert Frank has written about this, and his original book on it was a very interesting book, and his more recent stuff, I had a long exchange with him on my blog a couple of years ago and wasn't terribly happy with his responses, partly because I didn't think he was willing to follow out the logic of his own position. But I guess I would say that the relative status... Let me tell you a story about this, which goes back a long time ago. When I was an undergraduate at Harvard, I concluded that Harvard had the world's perfect social system because everybody there was at the top of his own ladder. That there was a small group of people who put on plays, I think in Lowell House, as I remember. And from their standpoint, the rest of us were there, just there to be an audience. And they were the people who mattered. They were the high status people. There was a small group of people who put a lot of time and effort into Young Republicans and Young Democrats. And from their standpoint, the rest of us were just there to be herded in to vote for them twice a year when they went, and so forth. Now, I'm exaggerating, obviously. But it struck me that that it seems at first as though status is a zero-sum game. because when I have higher, you have lower, and vice versa. But it isn't a zero-sum game, because people being sensible arrange their lives so that the status that matters to them is not status relative to 300 million Americans, which most of us don't even have the data to know. It's status relative to some set of people who they interact with regard to the things that they care about. So I think it is quite an implausible claim, which at one point Bob Frank was trying to make in the New York Times, to say that in general, rich people being rich subjectively harms poor people and vice versa. My next door neighbor being rich might subjectively harm me, but then I probably don't live next to somebody whose income is radically different from mine. So I don't think it makes a very plausible story. And I'm glad it doesn't, because as I pointed out to Bob Frank, the implication of his story is a world where everybody wants everybody else to be worse off. Because if he's right, then if I can, whether you're above me or below me on his theory, if I can just push you down, that helps me because I feel good. And he wasn't willing to, I mean, he said that was an ugly picture, but he didn't seem to be willing to face the fact that was the picture that he was drawing. That was the implication of his theory.
Could we just for a minute talk about what it's actually like to be poor in this society as opposed to what it's like to live in a Winthrop house rather than a Lowell house?
Sure.
Give me a break. When you are making the minimum wage, when you are living paycheck to paycheck and not putting food on the table every night, these arcane questions of which silo you are in with regard to status are not what concentrate your attention.
But that was his argument, and I was responding to his argument. Your argument depends on the factual claim that poor people would be better off under some set of institutions, and that's a factual claim which I am disputing. As far as I can tell,
never mind the Soviet Union.
I don't need the Soviet Union.
How about labor unions? How about not doing everything possible to destroy labor unions so that you can increase the wage of working class people? Something that you know what it's like because we had it until Reagan and others undertook to destroy it.
You're talking about the labor unions which were forcing down the wages of low-skilled workers and forcing up the wages of relatively high-skilled workers. The labor unions that were really effective were people like the typographers and the plumbers who used, in the case of the plumbers, used government restrictions in order to maintain the demand for their services by banning low-cost construction techniques, who, by holding down the number of their members and up their wages, were therefore pushing other people into other and lower pay. You have your beliefs about the world. I have mine. We could have a long argument about them. But you don't get to assume that I share your factual beliefs and that you can therefore argue against my conclusions without first persuading me that the institutions you are in favor of make people better off instead of worse off. I'm perfectly...
We'll have time for a longer argument.
Sure, of course, I agree.
To bring this back a little to the subject of the talk.
Right, fine idea.
And to build on something Michael said earlier, I'm skeptical that you can have both anarchism and libertarianism. I think you can have one or the other. And from a non-fictional standpoint, of course we know we could have anarchism because 98-99% of our existence as a species was under anarchism. Right, gather hunter tribes where there's no hierarchy, no centralized or specialized political authority, nothing like that. They're also a libertarian's worst nightmare, right? They're ferociously egalitarian from what we can tell.
Kill a lot of each other.
What?
Kill a lot of each other.
Apart,
very violent.
Apart from the question of violence. I mean, they're famous for, you know, if you go out on a hunt, right, and you're the best warrior and you bring back the lion's share of the meat, not only do you not get more than everybody else, but you have to sort of, in all the studies, you have to sort of ritualistically abase yourself and actually deny that you did better than anyone else. This is how they maintain, what are called egalitarian...
I'd have to look at much more, but that's my impression, which might be mistaken, is that there are sharing rules where they're a good deal less extreme than that. And I have to admit that I distrust anthropologists, probably for many of the reasons anthropologists distrust economists, partly because, for example, I did read a good deal of detail about the Margaret Mead controversy, where you had, you know, the most prominent anthropologist who, as far as I can tell, was giving a wildly false account.
But I'm not talking about Margaret. I'm just talking there's good evidence that they're very egalitarian. You can understand why. Now, on the other side, so the question is how do they, you know, do this? You know, no politics to speak of, no laws in the legal system. And I mean, I think the answer, and this is, gets part of my skepticism, is things like rights and obligations have to come from somewhere. And they come from one of two places, as far as I can tell. There are norms or there are laws. And it's usually some combination of both. But I think it's, I would pose it as a rule that the less you rely on codified, centralized laws for your society to function, the more there have to be very, very strong communal norms. And in those situations where there are very, very strong communal norms, there de facto can't be anything like libertarianism as I can understand it, because there's almost no way, this was Michael's question about no privacy, you know, there's no, people don't question the way things have always been done. There's no value in them. There's no value placed on innovation. As such, the more you move from a norm society to a society governed by codified laws, that's where you get these things libertarians claim to life, right? So I think you can't. It makes no sense to me to just say, okay, we'll have a society governed by individual contracts and obligations and stuff like that. What backs them up, right? Either the laws back them up, or norms back them up.
Can I answer?
They don't come from that. I mean,
my short answer is that my book, The Machinery of Freedom, was written 40 years ago. It's on my webpage for free as download as a PDF. And the institutions I am sketching are ones in which you have legal rules that are enforced by something other than norm mechanisms but are not made by a state. So that would be sort of the short answer. On the more general issue, I don't see why a norm-based system is necessarily inconsistent with private property market transactions. If you look, for example, at the norms that Ellison describes in Order Without Law, which include both current contemporary laws and new norms in Shasta County and rules such as the rules that whalers were using in the 19th century, which were norm-enforced, they are not particularly egalitarian rules, and they are rules which involve the enforcement of essentially property-style claims of different sorts, such as rules for the whalers about when one ship had harpooned a whale and another one brought it in, what the sharing rules were between them.
But aren't these not a state? I mean,
what?
Property markets, trade, aren't these not aspects
of the state?
Laws,
no.
Laws, aren't they?
No. They're aspects of human behavior.
Why don't I break a contract? Just because I fear the result.
There are a number of possible reasons you don't break a contract. One reason is that you want the reputation with people who deal with you that you keep your contracts. One reason is that someone else has in some way committed himself to do bad things to you if you break a contract.
Why can't my parents sell me into slavery if they're in debt?
When you say why can't they, that would depend on the society you're in. In quite a lot of state societies, they could. In, I think, Athens, after the reforms of Solon, they couldn't, if I remember correctly. Which of my society that I'm describing?
Because
I suspect if it was one that developed out of our society, if it developed out of our society with our society's norms, because people would not wish to think to be customers of rights enforcement agencies which enforce such rules, and also because enforcing slavery is costly enough that it is unlikely that the people who wanted to have slaves would be willing to offer enough to agencies to give them legal rules of that sort to make it profitable to do so. But we do know that lots of societies with states have had slavery of various sorts. It's been pretty much the norm until fairly recently.
What's the difference between rules and laws, then? I really, truly don't get it. Is there really any theory? I mean, are these distinctions without a difference? If you've got a system,
Would you like me to answer the question? I mean, for a long answer, you might want to look at an article on my webpage called A Positive Account of Property.
Please summarize.
I will. But I'm not going to talk long enough to...
Okay, but there must be a short answer.
The short answer starts out with the idea that rights describe a pattern of human behavior in which somebody is committed to bearing unreasonably, though not infinite costs, in order to prevent somebody else from doing something to him. That in a functioning society, this goes back to the question of how you ever get out of a Hobbesian war of each against all. And the answer is that you have a network of mutually recognized commitment strategies, such that you know that there are certain things that if you do to me, I will go to quite a lot of trouble to stop you. And I know similarly. And if the system is working, those commitment strategies rarely overlap, so that it's rarely the case that there is something where if you do it, I'll fight you, and if you don't do it, you'll fight me. That you then have a kind of order which is coming out of that network of commitment strategies. And ultimately, the reason, part of how you're able to build that network of commitment strategies is the idea of shelling points, of focal points. I haven't gotten to answer what the state is.
Some rational choice.
Keep going.
The question is, the question is not what is law, but what is the state? What is state enforced law? Because what I'm claiming is that what is special, the puzzle is why do we call some things governments and other things not governments, given that most things governments do, some other people sometimes do too. And my answer is that the government is the organization against which people have dropped those commitment strategies. So that the same thing that if you do to me, I'll go to a great deal of trouble to stop you, if the state does to me, I won't. That might be because I believe in legitimacy of the state. It might be because I believe the state has overwhelming power, and because I believe that other people will realize that that the state is different, and therefore my dropping my commitment strategies against it doesn't mean I've dropped it against them. But it is that organization which people let do the sorts of things, such as collecting taxes or drafting or whatever, that those people in that culture would forcibly resist if other people did them. And then the distinction is between those rules that are enforced by that kind of an organization and those rules that are enforced by other mechanisms. So I'm not sure that the distinction of laws to rules is useful.
But then could there be a state that is just contracts? This law? Just the law of contracts and nothing else? Would that not be a state?
The question is, can that law, in enforcing it, do things that people in that society see as illegitimate for individuals to do? So let us suppose, for example, that you have lent me $10 and I don't pay it back. If in our society the view is that it will be legitimate for you to grab $10 from me if I've refused to pay it back, and I'm thinking actually of a bit in Maimonides, which seems to assume that does sometimes happen in that society, then a quote, government, unquote, which takes the $10 from me and gives it to you after you prove that I owe it to you, is not a government in my terms. If, on the other hand, the view of people in that society is that for you to take the $2, even when it's perfectly clear that I owe it to you, is not legitimate. So that everybody expects that if you do that, I'll fight hard against you, and everybody expects that you won't fight hard to get the $10, but the state can do it, then it is a state. Ultimately, this goes back to territorial behavior in animals. If you think about how territorial behavior in animals works, it's ultimately a form of property right enforced by a commitment strategy. All right, that the animal marks territory it's claiming, and then somehow, and we don't know how, it turns a switch in its brain such that another member of the same species and gender trespassing on that territory, it will fight more and more desperately the deeper into the territory it comes. Fight to the death is a losing game for both players unless the trespasser is much stronger, in which case it's unfortunate for the defender. But as long as they're anywhere close to equal, the fact that the defender will fight to the death means the trespasser would lose by trespassing and the trespasser backs off. So that gives you a form of property rights, a very simple and primitive form of property rights, which does not depend on either moral, as far as I know, or the existence of a government to enforce it. And what I'm claiming is that you can understand why we are not living in a Hobbesian state of nature, why are we living in something much more orderly, by seeing a much, much more elaborate version of that same mechanism as explaining social order, with or without government. And this is not a point about government, but it becomes relevant because I had the puzzle for a long time of what defines a government, and thinking of it in terms of rights, not as a moral or legal category, but as a behavioral category, and government as that thing against which you drop the commitment strategies and enforce your rights, I think comes closer to giving me an explanation of why we call some things governments and don't call other things governments than I had before. And as I say, you can find various of my written stuff that has some of this explained.
Would it be fair to say, Dave, just to summarize your point, because we do need to pretty well, I think,
yep.
That big mistake that was made in the modern world was when people read Thomas Hobbes and did what he said. And they established a centralized state, which was basically a motley armed force, used to then enforce rules that were made. But a much better strategy would have been to follow the Icelandic notion of private ways of relating to one another, which were still rule-based and still recognized something like property, but that didn't depend upon a centralized force.
Correct. That is a system in which what's ultimately enforcing the rules is people's threats to use force against each other, but with some mechanism so that that threat is much more believable and the other person really has wronged me than what I haven't. That's what I refer to as a rule such that right makes might, which is, I think, what you need for feud systems to work. But it seems to me that the feud system, if you can make it work in your modern society, is a more attractive model for enforcing rules than the centralized hierarchical system. Yes?
In many of the stories that you described, they deal with the interplay between stateless societies and state-run
right.
societies. And it just seems, I mean, my limited knowledge that the historical record in general shows that, on the whole, stateless societies have lost in many of those conflicts, and regardless of whether a state is a moral or efficient way to order society, it's generally had a competitive advantage in dominating stateless societies. So I guess my question is, when an author presents a piece of fiction that describes a stateless society, you know, persevering against a state-based society, and there's not some sort of technological or magical justification for how this stateless condition has been maintained. Is this just a form of escapism, of imagining the world as not like it is?
Could be, depending on the author. But alternatively, if the author is clever, he figures out some reason that makes it believable. It isn't the same issue, but there's a science fiction novel called The Game Beyond, which, like many science fiction novels, has a feudal society in space. And unlike most of them, the author has thought about why. So that she has implicit in the story both an explanation of why that was, as it were, the sensible political organization to develop under the particular circumstances it did, and why it is now disappearing because the constraints that caused it to come into existence aren't there anymore. So it's not the same issue. It's the same thing that I think if you want to do a good job of such things, you've got to make some plausible account of why your thing works. Going back to your point, I'm not sure I know of cases where you had a poorer state against a richer stateless society. I think the cases that I'm used to, what's going on, part of what's going on at least, is that the stateless societies were generally relatively primitive societies. That I would have said that in the Comanche case, the stateless society probably did better than you would have expected given the relative resources,
sure, but
even though not well enough.
But the wealth is an aspect of
it. But the question that you think you'd then like to figure out which direction the causation is going.
Yes.
Is it that something about developed societies causes them to develop a state, which is a possible explanation? Maybe you say, well, look, they've got enough surplus to feed people who then can steal that surplus and rule the rest. Maybe that's what's going on. Or is it that having a state makes you richer? And obviously my argument would be that it's something in the former category or in the latter. A long time ago, I spoke at a libertarian event where I was speaking on Nozick's book, Anarchy, State, and Utopia, and he was in the audience. And so he spoke sort of afterwards responding. And he didn't try to defend the argument against anarchy he made in the book. He made what I've long thought is the best argument against my position, which is, if this system works, why don't we see it? And the best answer I can give to that, I think, is to imagine that it's a couple of hundred years ago, and someone is describing a really weird political system that couldn't possibly exist, one which is run by democratic vote, in which not only all adult males get to vote, even all the women get to vote, in which men and women have the same legal rights, in which governments control about 40% of all national income. If you go down the list, basically, of a set of characteristics such that I'm describing a society that as of 1800 has never existed in the history of the world and is now the norm of developed societies. So I guess the best answer I can make is only that the world is changing quite rapidly. Another of my books, Future Imperfect, is partly about the technological revolutions that may be happening. And therefore, although I don't know what's going to happen, I think ruling something out on the grounds that it has not, the combination of a stateless high-tech sort of rich society has not happened in the past, I don't think is reason to be confident that it can happen, although it's one argument against this happening. And that then goes back to my internet point, that one way it might happen would be a future in which you had essentially anarchy online, states running physical space, but once most of your life is online, you're very mobile. And if you're very mobile, the state can't exploit you very much before it leaves you, before it loses you. So that's one possibility.
All right, well, we should knock off. I guess we will attend to the hotel.